Well, just in just a moment, Dr. Sibyl will come up and bring his first address. We're very glad to see you all here, see a few others that have made it out just in the last few minutes as well. Glad that you are here. If you can't see the screen, then please feel free to move. Now would be a good time to do that. Shuffle along, make sure you can see clearly. Obviously that is there for a reason. Just before I introduce Dr. Sidwell, it's good to see Reverend Beers with us. Very glad that he has made it down safely from North Carolina. Not always guaranteed with the travel that way, as many of you are well aware. Glad he's made it in time for our meeting tonight. Look forward to him tomorrow morning. For the men folk, remember, be here sharp 8:30. We want to start sharp so that we don't delay the breakfast at 9:30. So if you can get here early in the morning, we appreciate that, and we look forward to that as well. As well as the Lord's Day, we continue through Sunday school 9:30, and then the services on the Lord's Day 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. God willing, and look forward to what the Lord will put before us. But we have tonight Dr. Sidwell, and we always have the privilege of being able to draw from those within our own ranks, and we're very thankful for that. And so I've been aware of these meetings, of course. Reformation meetings in this church go back, I don't know, some of you would know better than me, a long time. I know that definitely into the 80s, I remember seeing Dr. Cairns dealing with like the Swiss Reformation and different things that he dealt with even back as far as then, and was well known for Reformation Month, where he would take, I think, the evening services of the entire month of October and deal with themes with regard to the Reformation. And if you have never, I was just saying, someone was sending me a message from 2003, and I said to them, that was the best right there. That year, 2003, and the messages that Dr. Cairns brought that year, from my perspective, were memorable in ways that I just can't remember. I cannot forget, I should say. I was in the middle of trying to remember the various ones that he dealt with. There was the one on Cromwell, trust in God and keep your powder dry. There was the one about wanted men of God and preachers with passion and power. Those are, I'm trying to recall. I'm trying to do calculations in my head and speak at the same time. It doesn't always work. Anyway, those were very memorable. And to this day, I send those messages, at least the last two, to young men thinking of ministry. Because of the profound application of what is needed in the church and what is needed in ministry. So this church has endeavored to put before its people for years the importance of the Protestant Reformation. And I think that need is becoming ever more important. There is a lack of understanding of the distinction. Why are we Protestants? And what problem do we have with the Roman Catholic Church to this day? Of course, there are many that imagine that Rome has changed to a point that is we can kind of hold hands. Rome is worse today, theologically, than she was when Luther was fighting and Calvin was fighting for the truth. She is worse. And yet in many Protestant circles, a complete ignorance or even a move towards it, recognizing the baptism of Rome and endeavoring to link hands in various ways. So I think it's important that every year in some way we mark and we have opportunity to remind our people and others who will hear just how important it is that we remain distinctly Protestant for the right reasons. So Dr. Sidwell is here tonight. He was given a theme, Woman of the Reformation. That was assigned by someone, came up with that within our session. I can't remember who that was, but it was given to Dr. Sidwell to deal with. Of course, he has taught for many, many years, Bob Jones, history, School of Religion as well. He helps with our own seminary here, Geneva Reformed Seminary. Very thankful for all his contributions there as well. And really is someone who embodies his work. And I got an insight into that. I don't know how long I had been here. Maybe a year, maybe not quite. Came in Wednesday night, prayer meeting, And Dr. Sidwell was sitting right about there. And I said, "Dr. Sidwell, how are you?" And he said, "Oh, I'm just thinking about the Spanish-American War or something like that." I'm thinking, okay. Yeah, I was like, I don't want to say this in a bad way, that he lives in the past. I don't know, that could be a negative. But his mind is certainly often dwelling on the events and ramifications of what has occurred. I'm very thankful for his gift and the various gifts we have in this congregation. So we trust that you'll receive him well and God will use him tonight to encourage you. Dr. Sidwell, come please.
Well, I will just say that if you're teaching about something, you have to think about it sometimes. You don't know what you're going to do with it when you get into the classroom. I do appreciate the opportunity. Actually, they didn't, when it was presented to me, it wasn't an assigned topic. It said, "Would you be willing to do this?" And I thought, okay, that sounds like a good topic. I didn't realize I couldn't say no. And in fact, I have an interest in this topic. I teach the course in Reformation at the university, and I have a lecture there on women and the Reformation. So, in fact, if you were to go and take that course, you will hear parts of what you're hearing tonight in a different format, except that those people will take a test over it and you won't. So let's begin with some introductory thoughts. Now, I mentioned that I do have a lecture I normally give, and I've had an article published a few years ago. Did women, I know you probably can't read that very well, did women have a Reformation, the case of Catherine Zell? You don't know who Catherine Zell is? She'll actually be in toward the end of this presentation on Sunday morning. This appeared in the journal for Dr. Beakey Seminary up in Michigan. And you might look at that and think, why a title like that? Did women have a Reformation? Why would you even ask a question like that? Well, let me explain where it's coming from. And that will be our leading into what we're doing. The fact is that people experience history. We experience it differently. We experience it individually. Sometimes even things we have in common. I started thinking about this. You know, one of the things you can do is like, where were you and what were you doing when something happened? I remember one of our teachers, undergraduate, talking about where she was when she heard about Pearl Harbor, which, of course, before my time. My generation, we might ask, where were you and what were you doing when you heard that President Kennedy had been shot? Well, I was 5 years old in kindergarten, and I was watching TV, and the bulletin came on the TV, and my mother came running in from the kitchen to see what this was and what was happening here. One that more of us would have in common, where were you and what were you doing when you heard about the attacks on 9/11? I was working at the university library at that time. And one of my graduate assistants came in and said, "Dr. Sill, I heard somebody just flew a plane into one of the World Trade Center towers." And we turned on the radio there and listened to it. We were listening to the radio when the second plane hit, in fact, there as well. And I think I can actually get everybody in here. Where were you and what were you doing when you heard that Queen Elizabeth II had died? I was doing an afternoon class at the university, and we had a break in the middle of the class, and one of my students came up to me during the break and said, and had his phone there, "Look, Dr. Sill, Queen Elizabeth died." All right, so we all kind of experience these things, but we don't necessarily experience them the same way, or we may have different memories about them. For example, the Kennedy assassination, my mother came in thinking, the president has been shot. I'm thinking, my TV show just got interrupted. You know, I'm 5 years old. What do I know? More seriously, the trade tower, the 9/11 attack. I was reminded of this a couple of weeks ago because we sang Psalm 124 in the service here. And I remember this very distinctly. Oh, I remember much about that happening. It was just, you know, kind of a punch in the solar plexus kind of thing. And I remember that Sunday morning when we used to have campus church, I had to lead prayer on campus. And Stephen Jones was preaching, and we were talking about this beforehand. That evening, they had a memorial service here. I remember the church was packed. People were all wearing red, white, and blue ribbons, including our Ulster-born pastor, I might add. And we started by singing Psalm 124. And you look at that psalm and start singing that and start thinking about what that's saying in terms of what we had just endured the week before, and suddenly there's a whole new meaning. And here, everybody here, we could sit down and think, what were you thinking about when you heard that Queen Elizabeth died? You know, I mean, the only queen that most of us, probably everybody in this congregation, had ever heard of here. So there is this matter of how people see history. Okay, well, what about why do women have a Reformation? Why did you ask that question? Well, I know you can't see this in the previous article, but there, the footnote there, there's a reference to an article by a historian named Joan Kelly Goodall. Did women have a Renaissance? Now, what was she asking that for? Well, probably I know most of you don't care about arguments over history. Dr. Mask is up front, and he said basically once, historiographical questions bore people for the most part, arguments over history and interpreting history. And that's probably true. I found out with my students. But, you know, you've all heard of the Renaissance. But actually, there's a debate over the Renaissance. I mean, I teach the course in Renaissance now. I do this course. But there's actually a school of thought that says, well, beginning of the 19th century, historians started saying the Renaissance is the birth of the modern world. The Renaissance is the beginning of a new era and epoch in world history. And over the years, some historians have come to dispute that. No, the Renaissance was kind of a artistic and literary revival they had at the end of the Middle Ages in Europe. And they got back and forth on this and batted back and forth. Well, what this author was talking about, she's saying that as much as we had a Renaissance, her perspective was different, not denying a Renaissance, but saying women didn't experience it the same way that men did. Her idea of being the Renaissance was kind of an elite thing. I mean, obviously, not everybody was enjoying the artwork of Leonardo da Vinci or digging up Greek and Latin manuscripts out of monasteries, engaging in the new surge in literature and so on here. You know, for the average person, it probably didn't mean that much. And for women, her argument was, it meant even less because women, where they stood in society, how they were involved in life and so on, they wouldn't actually experience the Renaissance as much as men did. In fact, she had some arguments how it was actually negative for women. That's not all that important. But the question comes up then, okay, well, did women have a Reformation? And the answer to that, of course, is yes, not just because I'm presenting this tonight, but because, you know, the Renaissance, you could say, okay, maybe that was an elite movement that only certain parts of society really experienced if there was a Renaissance. But nobody denies that there was a Reformation. Furthermore, it was a mass movement. I'm reminded of a comment by historian Roland Bainton, you know, talking about, did women have a Reformation? Did they experience Reformation? Did they support the Reformation? And Bainton said, the women constituted a half of the population. And had they boycotted the movement, one may be sure that would have been the end of it. There's something to be said about that. But think of it this way. Imagine a husband and a wife, farmers, in southern Germany around 1500. What would the Renaissance mean to them? I mean, even whether as a man or a woman or a couple or anything, probably not a whole lot. They probably never saw Michelangelo ceiling the Sistine Chapel. They probably never read. In fact, they're probably illiterate. I mean, Gutenberg came up with the press, and that might have made some difference there. But for them, for the most part, probably not a lot of an impact. On the other hand, did the Reformation have an impact on what their farmers, and they had Catholic and Protestant armies marching over their fields during the wars of religion? They sure noticed that. But they went to church. Even if they went to a Catholic church, they would have been hearing things and hearing teachings and emphases that were different than what had been heard before. And, of course, even a Protestant land, a Protestant church, you're hearing something wholly different here. So, yeah, people had a Reformation. Women had a Reformation. And the question is, well, how did it take place? A picture here. This is an interesting example of Renaissance art. And you see it's called the chess game. This is interesting when you talk about women in the Renaissance because it's a woman painter, and that's unusual in itself. Most of the great painters of the Renaissance were men. Furthermore, she's painted herself and her sisters, and I guess their nurse there as well. So it's a portrayal of women, and they're playing chess. Okay, an intellectual thing, you know. In other words, there's kind of, some see in here kind of a statement of, you know, she's sort of presenting her view, her point, her emphasis on what this all means to us, to me as a woman and to others like them here. Well, I guess what I want to get to here is what did the Reformation mean to women in this way? Now, let's start here, though, with a look at theology. What I want to do here very briefly is just think about some of the important doctrines of the Reformation and ask, what do they mean to women? And I'm going to use a kind of a standard threefold definition: justification by faith alone, authority of Scripture alone, priesthood of the believers. Those are three great doctrines that pretty much all Protestants are going to agree with against the Roman Catholic Church. Think about justification by faith alone, for example. Now, as I thought about justification, I really couldn't think of anything that was specific to the interests or situation of women, but it was this point that there is built into justification a real idea of equality. First of all, that we are all equal in sin. We are all equally bound, all equally alienated. But that all people, well, there is no male or female in Christ. There is not bond or free, as Paul tells us here. That there is an equality of status that takes place, that all who are justified by Christ have the imputed righteousness of Christ reckoned to them. And there is an equal standing there, for there is no difference here. It's not that men, and actually people have taught this, men are in the image of God and women are sort of in a subordinate image of God or something, or a derived image of God some way. Rather, what we have here is this idea of equality. Well, how about the authority of Scripture alone? How does that read in? And of course, one of the things that we have as a breakthrough of the Renaissance, we really want to talk about a Renaissance influence, is the development of printing. And of course, Gutenberg, in his development of movable type printing, and of course, the Gutenberg Bible, as you see pictured here, it was a Latin Bible, a Latin translation. But this is obviously foreshadowing what's coming. I'm going to tell you a joke. And this joke comes from Dr. Panosian. So maybe you will laugh politely then. But talked about a fellow who had been in Europe. And he came back from Europe, and he went out to a friend of his who collected old books. And he said to him, "Hey, when I was in Europe, I saw something that might have interested you." He said, "What was it?" "It's this old Bible published by some guy named Guthen. Said Gutenberg." "Yeah, that's it, Gutenberg." "Well, why didn't you buy it?" "I would take it." "Look, you wouldn't have wanted it. Some guy named Luther had written all over the margins." Well, Luther probably did use the Latin here, and of course he also became very skilled in the Greek and the Hebrew as part of his translation work. Let me show you a little chart here. Well, I hit the wrong button. There we go. I teach an undergraduate course in the history of Christianity at the university. And I got the, and I was talking about the idea of the translation of the Bible, the authority of the Bible, and so on. And I went through our textbook, and I just decided I'm going to find every translation made of the Bible in the Reformation era, mentioned in this little textbook, not in some encyclopedia. And I was interested to see, all the different languages, all the different contributors, how many different ways, how many different people are involved in bringing the Bible into the language of the common people. I mean, Tyndale, that was his whole burden, that men and women would have the Scripture to read for themselves. And what does this, what's the ramification for this? Well, I think one is education. The fact is that the Protestant reformers saw education as important so that people could read the Scriptures for themselves. You read Tyndale's story, and Tyndale was aware that people were being deceived and led astray because they couldn't read the Bible for themselves. And a guarantee, a stake, and the fact is that women also profit. Now, in the day and the time of the Reformation, it was still easier for a man to get education than a woman. But there now was an upsurge. Germany, in fact, actually did better than some other parts of Europe in providing at least a common education for women at that time. So women were now being able to read and, of course, use that reading for the reading of the Scripture there as well. The third principle, of course, is the priesthood of believers. And I had to sit and think, how do you picture the priesthood of believers? And I thought of this. What you see here is a Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible, was a Puritan translation, kind of one of the forerunners of the King James Version. And the Geneva Bible is a remarkable document or print publication in many ways, one of which is in a sense, the first study Bible. The Geneva Bible was not a large pulpit Bible like most of the translations had been at this time. Tyndale had been trying to publish them smaller size and so on. The Geneva people, by the way, the Geneva Bible was translated by English exiles in Geneva fleeing from Queen Mary and her persecution. Just that's hence the name. So it's not in French, it's in English. It's the first Bible, though. It was portable. You could carry it around and read it. It was the first English Bible to have the verse divisions put in there. As you can see from this picture, they put maps, they put marginal notes, they put other things. In other words, it's a Bible for you to read and to study. And this Bible was then being published and distributed and put in the hands of men and women. So while we don't think of something particularly feminist, I guess you would say, of the great doctrine of the Reformation, there was a definite impact upon women there. Now, let's start looking at how the Reformation began to affect not just doctrine, in a sense, the ramifications of doctrine for life and culture here. Let's think here in the view of the family as it shifted in the Reformation. Now, first of all, you've got to understand, what was the Reformation changing? And that's an important thing to keep in mind. We all call it the Reformation. Well, what were they reforming? What was different? What was it that the reformers and their followers, their students, the teachers, what was it that they saw as different from the Middle Ages here? Well, understand, first of all, the medieval view. You have here before you St. Jerome, and one of his comments, marriage replenishes the earth, virginity fills paradise. And, of course, the main idea of the Middle Ages was that celibacy and virginity was more holy. If you really want to be holy, then practice celibacy. Of course, become a priest, monk, nun, that's all part of that as well. That's the really spiritual thing to do. And also as a part of this, as we think about the change, is the medieval view of vocation. Now, to us, vocation means your job. You know, my vocation, I'm a history professor. Your vocation is whatever it is there as well. But vocation, of course, is calling. In the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church had the emphasis that vocation is just for people in the service of the church. If you're a priest, if you're a monk, if you're a nun, you have a calling. If you're doing something else, you know, well, there's ramifications of this in terms of things like economics. You have people speculating that the Protestant view of all callings as holy vocations has its impact upon economic life as well. That's beside the point for us. What is to the point for us is to begin to see a different way of looking at the family here and marriage. But what's different about it? Well, let's look at here one of our most famous couples, of course. This is Luther and his wife, Katie, Catherine von Bora Luther. I'll actually say a little bit more about her later in this presentation, focusing on their marriage as such. But let's talk about this as a family here for a moment. One thing, you know, it's interesting. The Reformation turned from the Catholic idea of marriage as a sacrament. They denied the idea that marriage is a means of grace. But they didn't diminish marriage. In fact, they actually brought a new emphasis to it. Marriage and family became a vocation, a calling, an activity, a institution with a holy purpose in God's design here. In other words, marriage is not just a matter of, well, we've got to have another generation of people after this one, so I guess some people have to get married. You can't manage your lust, get married. But it's more spiritual not to do that. And, of course, you also have the idea here that vocation, how can I put this? This is what God intends as a means of growth, nurture, and edification as well. The idea of the family as a school of faith. That is, that the family was a place also for the teaching of the children, the bringing up here, that it was to be a school for Christ in a way. And so it's often popular of artists here to put Martin Luther's family in kind of the family circle picture, although the fellow on the kind of the left-hand side or the back is Philip Melanchthon, who was not part of his family. Melanchthon was kind of the main, you know, right-hand man to Luther. For some reason, he shows up in a lot of these illustrations, as we'll see some more in just a moment. But the whole idea that this was a place where you would gather and teach. And it's interesting. I just learned this while I was working on this presentation. The Catholic Church really didn't favor the idea of the home or family being a teaching center. They said things like catechism should be the business of the church. The bishop should be overseeing it. I mean, who knows what that family might be doing with those children? Make sure, and the Council of Trent, which is the Catholic reaction to the Reformation, they actually sat down very soon. I mean, we don't think the Council of Trent, you know, they condemned justification by faith and so on as they did. They talk about a lot of things. What kind of church music you should have? What would family life be like? What should you not be doing in the family? It was a very far-reaching kind of thing. And so there's this new way of looking at the family here as well. I have to insert for here one picture. For some reason, It's a popular thing to show Luther and his family at Christmas. It became a popular subject here for a lot of artists to put in. In fact, some of you may have heard the story that Luther wrote Away in a Manger. And sometimes there's even hymn books will put his name there. He didn't. It was written in English hundreds of years after he was dead. And some theorize it got attached to Luther because the first time it was published, it was put in a hymn book, you know, page here, and a picture of Luther and his family at Christmas on the opposite side. Maybe, maybe not. I do have to say about this picture two things, though. First of all, apparently Luther has given his son a crossbow for Christmas. You talk about your dangerous toys for Christmas here. And it sure looks to me like Philip Melanchthon is telling the kid to shoot your crossbow at the Christmas tree here and see what happens. I don't know what was intended there as well. So there's a new way of looking at the family here in the Reformation as a result of the doctrinal teaching. And you understand, doctrine has consequences. And that's why we have such an emphasis on doctrine and theology and truth. Because that's where the true practices, the true patterns for our life are going to emerge as well. Well, now before we go out farther, let's look for a moment at Catholic response. All right, the Reformation breaks out. It starts affecting so much, and it affects women, views of women, family, and so on. How does the Catholic Church respond to this? You know, the Catholic Church is not, they're not foolish in a human way of speaking here. They're trying to think, what can I do? What should we do to bring people back, to hold people in? How can we do this? Well, a lot of it was on my emphasis on the Holy Family, as it's often called here. I mean, preeminently, of course, what they did was emphasize the Virgin Mary. I mean, Mariology, the emphasis upon Mary, the teaching upon Mary, goes back early into the Middle Ages, early to the late ancient church. You can find traces of this even going back to the second century among some writers making comments here. It's kind of a development of growth here. But the obvious thing is, well, if you want to appeal to women and to mothers, uphold to them the Virgin Mother, the perfect mother. Let Mary be your model. Let Mary be your pattern. Practice your devotion to her in this way. And of course, it's a paradox here that Mary is the Virgin Mother because, of course, Catholics don't believe she and Joseph ever had children. Mary was a virgin her entire life. So they're kind of taking the virginity emphasis that they had before and tying it with a motherhood emphasis as a way, in the sense of appealing to Catholic women in this way. Here's an interesting shift that writer Peter Wallace pointed out to me in one of the books I read. This is a Renaissance-era portrayal of the Holy Family here. Masaccio was an early Renaissance artist there, 15th century, I think it was. And what you'll notice here, this Holy Family is Mary, the Christ child, and Anne. Anne, in tradition, is the mother of Mary. You guys remember the story you've heard about Martin Luther? He's going back to school after a trip home while he's in university. He goes out and gets caught in a thunderstorm. He runs under a tree and he calls out, "Saint Anne, help me. I'll become a monk." Why St. Anne? Well, St. Anne was a patron saint. Luther's father was a miner, not that he was under 18, but I mean he dug things out of the ground, or he was actually higher level than that. And that was his patron saint, so he prays to St. Anne. And the tendency to show this in pre-Reformation art and Catholic art was to show Mary with her mother, is that pattern. But interestingly enough, after the Reformation, Catholics began to replace Mary with Joseph. Almost as though, okay, we want to give here a mother and a father figure. We want a Holy Family model for them as well. And this way we can kind of offset some of this family emphasis we're finding with the Protestants. Now, I might notice here in passing, you'll usually notice that Joseph is usually portrayed as elderly. One of the Catholic arguments is that Joseph actually was an older man. In fact, Joseph already had children. Those children you read about in the Bible, one Catholic view is that, well, those were Joseph's children from an earlier marriage. They were actually all older than Jesus, not younger than Jesus. And all that. So you show Joseph as older here, as an older man. But still, so you still got kind of the Catholic doctrine being protected, but you're trying to spin it in a different way so it will have more appeal to people for their devotion, for their life, and so on here as well. Now, another way that Catholics could look at approach women and women's issues here were the tradition of nuns, that is, women who lived in a convent. They were cloistered here. The fact is that they had a number of female orders. In fact, the Reformation itself spawned new Catholic orders. And we often hear about the Jesuits, a men's order which was out there to recapture from the Protestants all that they had lost in the Reformation. But there were new female orders as well. For example, what you see pictured here are the Ursulines, which were founded after the Reformation began. Kind of interesting story here. The founder of this is Angela Merici of Brescia. And she used this, of course, as a way of getting women united for devotion to the church and all of that. She also, though, had the idea of making it a teaching order, that it, you know, kind of like the Dominicans were a teaching order for the Catholics going out and instructing. She had here to teach women and reach women with instruction on behalf of the church. It's interesting, too. They didn't wear the usual habits that were worn by nuns at that time. They wore a different kind of dress and so on. And in fact, they were kind of seen as a little bit too much freedom from the Catholic Church. Eventually, the Pope kind of pulled them back. He made them cloister. He made them wear the regular habit and so on here. But this was at least initially an example here of how they would try to reach women by a traditional means of Catholic devotion, to become a nun. Another one that Catholics used was mysticism. And probably the most famous of the mystics of the Counter-Reformation is Teresa of Avila. And this is the famous sculpture by Bernini of her in one of her ecstatic visions. Okay, why did the Catholics use mysticism? Well, one thing that the Reformation obviously appealed to people was a personal element. You, as a priest, may come unto God. You may pray directly to God with only Christ as your intercessor. No saints, not Mary, anything like that. You can know assurance of salvation. Okay, there is something about that that really speaks to the individual person and his or her heart here. Well, mysticism is kind of a way to kind of, if people are interested in that sort of thing, they could become mystic. Now, you understand, they're not saying everybody should be mystics, because they wouldn't like that at all. But if people are interested in personal experience, if they're interested in some kind of personal involvement here, well, mysticism is the route to go to their way of thinking. You can have direct experiences of God, apart from Mary and the saints and everything else. You can have visions. You can have, okay, do you see the point? You're able to experience personal religion within Catholic means, Catholic channels this way, by that kind of pattern here. And also, of course, it's one of the few ways that women... And one thing I didn't say about nuns, one reason that nuns also, that Catholics try to appeal, this is a place for, you know, what can women do in the church? Can women have leadership in the church? Obviously, the Catholic Church doesn't have female priests or anything. But if you could become a nun, one of the things you could seek to do is to become, you know, the abbess of your convent here. You could become the chief nun, as it were. Sorry, when I think about the chief nun, I think about somebody looking out a window and singing "Climb Every Mountain." Sorry, obscure pop culture reference there. But basically, okay, the same thing here. Mysticism, women who really wouldn't have a place or role within the, you know, the male hierarchy of the Catholic Church, could suddenly find a role, a place, a religious devotion that couldn't be found elsewhere. It's interesting, Teresa of Avila went through a lot of trouble in her life because the Catholic Church was very unsure about her. Anybody that has visions and this sort of thing, the Church is kind of worried about. But finally, after she was dead, they declared, of course, her a saint. In fact, they made her a doctor of the Church. Now, doctors of the Church in Catholicism are figures who are seen to be outstanding leaders in terms of the doctrine and faith and practice. Like Thomas Aquinas is a doctor of the Church. Some of the early Church fathers have been kind of posthumously labeled doctors of the Church, like Augustine and so on. Well, there are four women who are considered doctors of the Church in the 20-some or 30-some doctors that the Church identifies. And Teresa of Avila is one of those. So we have here then an example of the Catholic Church trying to find a way to appeal to women, but use regular Catholic devotion, not changing the doctrine, but saying what do we have in our arsenal of from the past that we can use now to reach and accommodate women and families and the rest here. So the Catholic Church didn't stand still for all of this. Now, we wanted next, the last portion of this, we're going to be looking at women in different roles. And here's kind of what probably some of you were thinking. You're going to tell us about outstanding women, individual women. Well, I'm actually going to try to deal with that some, although not all of these will be outstanding, as you will see. But we want to talk about some people who were important to the Reformation in different roles and how they fulfilled those roles, how they approached them, how they embodied the Reformation teaching, or in a few cases, how they set themselves against Reformation teaching. And queens is the first office, the first position I want to look at here. And I'm going to start, oddly enough, with John Knox. And you're thinking, okay, John Knox was not a queen for a lot of other things here. Why is John Knox showing up here, first of all? Well, because when you start talking about women and the Reformation, you're going to hear about the first blast of the trumpet against the monstrous regiment of women, a work that John Knox wrote here. Now, I always tell my students, you know, the monstrous regiment of women, it sounds like Knox is denouncing an army of female zombies. Really, what is monstrous means unnatural, and regiment means rule. That is, what he is condemning here is the unnatural rule by women. And you can imagine today that's gotten a lot of attention, but even before modern feminist concerns, there were a lot of people who kind of looked at Knox about all this. Like, what are we talking about? Well, let's take, for example, you know, there are women in the Bible. What does Knox do with that? Let's go look at Deborah. And Knox says of Deborah, God exempted Deborah from the common malediction given to women. And against nature, he made her prudent in counsel, strong in courage, happy in regiment, and a blessed mother and deliverer to his people. I mean, okay, Deborah, she was the exception here. And although not all this book is of this particular flavor here, you can see how people would look at this. Well, you have to understand here what's going on with Knox. Because if you look at the situation that Knox was going through in his work, you begin to understand a little bit better why he is saying this. Because, for example, Mary Tudor, Mary the First, Bloody Mary as she's called. We'll be talking a little bit more about her later. Knox had been serving in England under King Edward VI. And when King Edward died and Edward's half-sister Mary came to the throne to try to restore the Catholic Church, of course, Knox had to flee. He was one of those people like the Geneva Bible translators who had to flee to the continent. That's how Knox ended up in Geneva for a while and studied under Calvin and all of this. So he's got this oppressive queen now in England. And do you remember at this time, England and Scotland are separate countries. Knox was a Scot, but he had been serving in England here. Furthermore, in his native land, he had Mary Guise. Now, Mary was the wife of King James V of Scotland. And King James V died and left only one child, an infant daughter, who we're going to come across here, Mary. And so Mary Guise, of course, becomes the regent. She becomes one of the people ruling in the name of her daughter. By the way, her daughter, she takes her and sends her to France. Guise is a French name. She was from a very strong pro-Catholic family. In fact, if any of you have ever studied the French Reformation, you know you have the Guise family are one of the really strongly pro-Catholic factions, not just in pushing the church, but in killing Protestants as well. So she sends her daughter back. So Mary, Queen of Scots, was actually brought up as a French woman. And she was married, in fact, to the French king, but he died young as well. And so now Knox has Mary Tudor on the throne. And then he has these clashes with Mary Guise in his own homeland here, on top of that. And then, of course, although we eventually have the battles between Knox and Mary, Queen of Scots. We'll talk about her later. Now, actually, that didn't occur until after Knox had written this book. So he wasn't thinking of Mary, Queen of Scots when he wrote it, but he probably would have, you know, made it that way. The problem for Knox is this, that about the time he publishes this book, Elizabeth comes to the throne of England. And Elizabeth was not amused. She didn't like Knox very well, and Knox didn't really like her very well, although he tried to be. Basically, he said, well, look, I wasn't talking about you. okay? Because they're hoping that Elizabeth's going to be the salvation, the rescue of the English Reformation. We'll talk more about Elizabeth later here as well. Now, I have to say this on behalf of Knox, though, as some of his biographers and others have noted. His opposition to these queens and that generalizing that to an opposition to women rulers should not be taken as the whole of his opinion about women. For example, often others will note about his relationship, and I don't mean relationship anything romantic, anything, his counsel and help to a woman, Elizabeth Bowes, and how he was basically exchanged correspondence with her, helping her, leading her, guided her. And in fact, eventually Knox married her daughter. His second wife, I can't remember now. And so he had this very close relationship with her and, of course, eventually his daughter. And it was a pastoral relationship, a time of sharing, helping. In fact, some of those letters still exist. And it gives you a little different view of Knox's attitude toward women than the monstrous regiment would give you there. And when you talk about queens, we've got to talk about Henry VIII. Henry VIII, King of England, who broke with the Church of Rome, as we all know. And as every student can tell you, Henry VIII had six wives. One divorced, one beheaded, one died, one divorced, one beheaded, one survived. Okay? And that's the little formula we give people to remember his six wives here. And you see them pictured for you here. Catherine of Aragon was his first wife, but she couldn't give him a... You know, Henry wanted a son. He wanted a male heir because he thought England's going to go back into chaos again like we just had with the Wars of the Roses a few years before this. And so when Catherine of Aragon does not have a surviving son, he wants to put her away. And of course, the Pope can't let him do that because the Pope is under the control of Emperor Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire. And Charles V is the nephew of Catherine of Aragon. So, the Pope's stuck, and he just keeps trying to punt, you know, until finally, you know, Henry's mistress, Anne Boleyn, is pregnant by this time, so Henry has to do something. So he gets Parliament to break this, and he becomes essentially his own Pope. I'm going to be head of the Church of England and all of that. And then, of course, Anne Boleyn never gives birth to a son. He gives birth to the daughter, Elizabeth. He finally gets a son from his third wife. She dies shortly thereafter. I won't go through the whole story with the other three wives. I'll just mention this. In terms of the Reformation itself, from what I have read about this, Anne Boleyn seems to have had some sympathy for the Reformation. John Fox, for example, the famous English historian and martyrologist, was very impressed by Anne Boleyn from what he knew. I think it was all secondhand in his case. But he puts some rather flattering things about her in his history and work. And then likewise, the final wife of Henry, the one who survived him, Catherine Parr, seems likewise to have had a sympathy with the Reformation and to have done things to help to the support of people like, well, Lady Jane Grey, we'll talk about later here as well. But the fact is that the story of Henry's wives is an unhappy one. And of course, if you want to, you can buy a cup. And if you fill it with a hot beverage, you can watch the six wives of Henry VIII vanish from sight right before your eyes. In fact, when I was on the tour, we were in the Tower of London. I went in the gift shop. And in the gift shop, they had the six wives of Henry VIII as bars of soap. So you could watch them disappear as you washed your hands through time there as well. So what we have here then is the setup of, okay, the queen, the office of the queen, how do they fit in? Well, what I'm going to do, and this will be actually what we'll start then on Sunday, is talk about some of the bad queens, the bad examples here, and how they were a part of the Reformation story. Some of the queens who have a better reputation, certainly, but then go on to other roles, particularly those of the martyrs and those of the pastor's wife. And so, Lord willing, Sunday, we will pick up at this point then, and we begin, continue with the queens, and look at their place in the Reformation and go on from there.